that you can be born into a particular religion. What does that mean? How is that even possible? Religion should be something that you follow because it's true and that it's right, and not simply because your parents follow it. And the whole conception of different religions is as being, you know, my religion is better than your religion. It strikes me again as some sort of national thing that we have a war over, or some sort of a football game. You know, my team is better than your team, and I'm going to defeat you on the playing field. Of course, we may ask the question, well, why are there different religions? And my understanding is there's different religions because different people are willing to accept God or approach spirituality in different ways, and not everyone's willing or open to approaching spirituality in the same way. I think it's a similar question as to why are there different schools? Why doesn't every school teach in exactly the same way? You know, I was a teacher for 27 years, and 19 of those years I was also a school administrator. And I remember when parents would come to see our school, was a private. One year I was an administrator in public school, but the rest of that time was a private school. And when parents would come to see the school to consider whether or not they wanted to put their children in the school, I learned that different people were looking for different things. So like in our math class, the kids were all sitting quietly at their desks working in their books. But in our geography classes, the kids were in different groups and they were doing projects and things like that. And so in one class, the kids were just sitting very quietly at their desk. In another class, it was very noisy and interactive and creative. And I found that different parents would like different things. You know, some parents, if they came, bless you, during the math class would say, oh, what a great school, I want to send my kids here. Everything is so disciplined and orderly. And other parents, if they came during the math class, would say, this is a terrible school, the kids aren't having any fun. And it would work the other way too. You know, if some people came during the geography class and they'd say, wow, this is so creative and it's so interactive and you're doing so many exciting things, I want my kids to come here. And other people would say, oh, it's totally chaotic. You know, there's no way would I want my kid coming here. And so I learned before inviting people to the school to ask them, you know, well, what are you looking for? And although education is education is education, math is math is math, still different people are going to want to approach it in different ways. And the same is true with spirituality. Another reason perhaps that there's different religions is that different religions teach spirituality at different levels. Just like Jesus told his followers, I have many things to teach you that you cannot bear to hear. When he talked about a second birth, they said, oh, you mean we go back into our mother's womb as an adult and we take, what are you talking about? And he said, you're not ready to understand this. He said, I'm teaching you just the basics. Of course, there are certainly Christians who have achieved the heights of spiritual realization. Sometimes in elementary school, some children are doing math at a PhD level. They're going beyond the teachings of their school, and I'm sure some people in Harvard are just getting drunk at parties and wasting their time. So some people in a very high form of spirituality are functioning at a low level, and some people at a more elementary form of spirituality are functioning at a higher level. But these different forms of religion and spirituality are meant for different flavors for different people, or different levels, or some combination of both. And thinking, you know, we have the only true religion is a little arrogant. So this was what was going on at that time between the Muslims and the Hindus. And the Muslims' rulers particularly were incensed that Haridas had not only become, in their view, a Hindu, they couldn't understand, oh, he's taking up the eternal religion. They didn't think of it like that. They thought he's converted to another religion. He's left Islam. And they said, you're setting a bad example for the other Muslims. They'll also leave Islam. So he was brought before the local ruler. And the local ruler was inclined not to be very harsh with him, but one of his advisors said, you know, you've got to kill this guy. You've got to set an example. And he should be killed through severe torture. So they're met, and very publicly. You know, in America, there's only a few states anymore that execute people, and it's very private, and it's supposed to be, right, we have in the Constitution against cruel and unusual punishment. It's supposed to be very fast and as painless as possible. But it used to be in the world that when people were executed, they tried to make it as public and as painful as possible. They were trying to have a deterrent, and people would come for public hangings. Even in this country, it used to be like that. So they said, all right, well, the way we're going to kill him is we're going to have him beaten in 22 marketplaces, 22 downtown areas. You know, we're going to take him where everybody congregates downtown, and we're going to beat him there in front of the public, And we're going to go from one village to another up to 22 times. So Haridas, being a very great saintly person, even though he was beaten, he had no marks on his body, he had no pain, and he was simply singing. He was just singing the holy names of the Lord. And he was absorbed in transcendental bliss. Now, it is entirely possible, even for a materialistic person, to situate their mind in such a way that they do not feel pain. That is entirely possible. I've had that experience myself, and I've met people who are not even spiritually inclined. I met one medical doctor who was allergic to anesthesia, and when she had to have some stomach surgery, she just used hypnosis. She just put her mind in a different state. So that's possible even on the material level. What to speak of if you're absorbed in the transcendence? So if you're absorbed in the transcendence, you're really, the things of the world become inconsequential to you. And he really was barely aware that they were beating him. And this is going on and on and on. And finally, the persons who were beating him, they started to become very upset. And they said, Haridas, we were ordered by the government to kill you. And if nothing happens to you, we may be executed for dereliction of duty. And we don't know what to do. And he said, oh, I don't want to cause anyone any trouble. So this is the mood of a saintly person. The mood of a saintly person is, no matter how much trouble you're causing me, I do not want to cause any trouble to you. A materialistic person likes to cause trouble to those who cause trouble to them. In fact, it's our great delight. If somebody harms us in any way, even an insult, even if someone says, oh, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. What are you doing that for? You know, our tendency is to retaliate. Well, what about you? You do stupid things too. And this goes on even among close friends, among family members. Right? I mean, it's quite common that you'll be around friends or family and somebody, one person says something nasty and the other person retorts with something nastier. Right? And they keep escalating the insults. Or someone has hurt you in some way, cheated you in some way, and then you find out their business has failed and you go, great, so good. I'm so glad their business failed. I remember when they cheated me out of $1,000. You know, that's our general mood. And our general mood is we want to do good for those people who are either doing good for us or who are neutral, but not for our enemies. However, the mood of spirituality is not like that. The mood of spirituality is that I don't have any gains or loss in this world. I'm a spiritual being. I have nothing to do with this world. And there's no one who can hurt me, nor is there anyone who can benefit me, materially speaking. And that I am getting everything I need from my relationship with God, with Krishna. And therefore, I can just be nice to everybody. That doesn't mean that you invite, you know, psychopathic criminals into your house and feed them, you know, jam and milk or something. It's not that one does that. It's not that you go into the cage with a tiger and start embracing them. One has a little common sense. But there's no enmity. There's no envy, there's no malice towards anyone. So when Haridas Thakur heard that these guards, these government persons, that they were going to have to suffer because he didn't die, he said, oh, I don't want to give you any trouble. And immediately he went into a very, very deep state of trance. Now, again, there are people who can do this mechanically. It's called a cataleptic trance. There was a very famous person called Wolf Messing, who was a German Jew, and he ended up going over to Russia and getting the shelter of Stalin during World War II. And he had a lot of psychic abilities. One of them was to put himself in a cataleptic trance. When he was a teenager, the way he made a living was he would go for the weekend to a wax museum, put himself into a cataleptic trance, and be there as if he was one of the wax figures. And that was how he earned his pocket change as a teenager. At one point he visited India, and he wrote that in India he found yogis who could go into a cataleptic trance for up to 3 weeks. And in that state, there's practically no pulse or heartbeat. They go into like a state of deep hibernation. But Haridas Thakur wasn't doing this through some sort of mystic yoga. He was doing this through a state of love. And this is one of the differences between bhakti yoga and what's called Astanga Yoga or Raja Yoga or Dhyan Yoga, in Dhyan Yoga, Astanga Yoga, Raja Yoga, there's different names. One goes into samadhi by manipulating the air in the body and the way that one is situating one's mind, and thereby you go into a state of trance. Of course, most people on the planet today, no matter how much they would study these kinds of yogas, could not go into that deep of a state of trance. But the way that Haridas Thakur went into that trance was different. And it's the way that he did it is something that we all have experience of. We all know that when we're thinking about something that has a lot of emotional charge for us, positive or negative, we can lose awareness of our surroundings. If I'm thinking about, you know, maybe I'm going to get fired at work today, or I'm thinking about how I'm going to take my first overseas trip to, you know, Antarctica tomorrow, whatever. If I'm thinking about something where I have a lot of emotional investment, where I feel a lot of emotion, the world goes away. Right? If you're really in love with somebody, again, you become fully focused on that person. And you may not even notice someone's talking. What did you say? Because you're not there. So Haridas Thakur, he went into the state of deep, deep trance, just absorbing himself in Krishna and Krishna's activities in the spiritual world. And so he appeared to die. And they thought, oh, great, he's dead. So they took his so-called dead body back to the capital, back to the local ruler, and they said, okay, we've done it, we've killed him. And what should we do now? Should we bury him? Because the Muslims bury their dead. The Hindus cremate their dead. They said, no, if you bury him with a proper funeral, then it will elevate his soul. But we want him to suffer even in the next life. So don't give him a proper burial. Just throw him in the Ganges River. So they threw him in the Ganges River, and eventually he came back to external consciousness and started walking around the town again. At which point the Muslim rulers and police officers saw him and brought him back to the ruler, who then fell at his feet and apologized and said, I accept that you're actually a saintly person. Now, it's far more intelligent to recognize saintly persons not by their miracles, but by their general consciousness and their teaching and their whole way of life. And Haridas particularly demonstrated his saintliness in the fact that he could be absorbed all day and night simply in meditating on the Lord and chanting the Lord's names. And he was called the Namacharya because he would chant, it said, 300,000 names or 192 circles on a bead, on the 108 beads. So if you chant 16 times the beads, which most of us in the Hare Krishna movement do, that takes an hour and a half, 2 hours. And imagine how long it would take to chant around 192 times. It would take you most of the day. And that was his absorption. There are other miracles associated with Haridas. One time he was just living in a cave where there was some sort of a poisonous snake that was giving off such a foul odor that the other people didn't like to come to the cave. Haridas didn't notice the smell. But people who would come there to hear from him, to learn from him, they said, you know, you really have a bad smell in here. I think you have a snake in the cave. And Haridas said, well, if the snake isn't gone by tomorrow, I'll leave and relocate to another place. He said, so don't worry about it. By tomorrow, either the snake or I will leave. And at that moment, the snake comes out and leaves the cave. So we have many, many stories like this about Haridas. Perhaps another very interesting story, again, involves one of the Muslim rulers who was very angry at the fact they felt that Haridas was setting a bad example for the local Muslims by chanting Hindu names. So instead of trying to kill Haridas, they sought to kill his reputation. So this, if you want to destroy your enemy, you know, you can go and shoot them, but if you're a little bit more civilized, then you'll make a blog on the internet and you'll say all kinds of nasty things about them. Right? So that's a little bit more civilized than getting at a gun. And you try to shoot them that way. So the way that the local ruler decided to do this is he decided to employ a local prostitute to go visit Haridas, and then he would have his constables find Haridas with the prostitute and say, oh, just see, he's not really a saintly person. He's consorting with prostitutes. So this one prostitute agreed. She said, okay, sure, if you pay me enough money, I don't mind. And so she came there one night, and Haridas was just chanting and singing. And he said, oh, my dear, beautiful young woman, he said, I'd love to enjoy with you and have union with you, but I've taken a vow. I've taken a vow that I'm going to just be absorbed in the holy name of the Lord, and I just haven't finished. I have a vow that this month I'm going to chant so many names of the Lord. I haven't finished, but probably I'll be able to finish tonight, so just stay here and wait. And as she was waiting, she heard his chanting and his singing. And sometimes she would sing along with him. So the sun rose, and he said, I'm sorry, I haven't finished. If you come back tomorrow, I'm sure I'll finish. And then the local ruler said, so, you didn't call for anybody. She said, well, he promised tomorrow. You know, so again, the same thing happened the next night. The next night, again, she was more and more, she was singing along with him and chanting along with him. And he said, I'm so sorry. I haven't been able to finish my vow. Maybe you can come back tomorrow. So she came back the next day. And that day she was even more singing and chanting. And in the middle of the night, all of a sudden she said, I'm so sorry. She said, I'm a prostitute. And I was hired to come here to make you fall down. And then we could have all these witnesses come and your reputation would be ruined. And she said, I'm so sorry. And he said, well, I already knew what was going on. He said, I was hoping that your heart would change. And she said, I want to give up my occupation and my life and dedicate myself now to spirituality. He said, take all the money that you've earned through your profession, give it to saintly persons, and come back here just wearing a simple cloth. So she shaved off her hair, put on a simple cloth, and she came there, and he said, now you just stay here. And you just chant and you meditate on Krishna, and he left. And she became so renowned herself as a saintly person that many of the top religious and spiritual people of the area came to see her and take instruction from her. And so this was an amazing miracle we see a similar theme. People are coming to harm him, but instead of harming them in return, he does good to them in return. So this is the basic mood of Haridas. As I said, today is the anniversary of his passing, and his passing was also rather miraculous. So, thank you. So one day when Lord Chaitanya came to see him, he said, I've heard that you're not taking your meals. And he said, well, I haven't been able to finish my chanting, so I don't want to eat until I finish my chanting. I'm just too old. I'm not able to finish my chanting anymore. Lord Chaitanya said, well, now that you're old, you don't have to spend so many hours just in your prayers. And Haridas said, no, I think really it's the time has come for me to leave this world. He said, I really don't want to stay and see you leave. I would like to leave first. So Lord Chaitanya said, well, I don't want to be in this world without you either. He said, but whatever you like. So the next day, so many of the devotees of the Lord came to see Haridas. And he was just lying there chanting and chanting and chanting. And then he just looked at the face of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And he said, Sri Krishna Chaitanya. And by his own will, choosing his own time, like a great yogi, he passed away from his body. And at that time, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had a huge festival. They bathed the body of Haridas with the ocean water, and they had a huge, huge festival in the whole town that all the shopkeepers contributed to. And this particular story shows us that not only do the devotees of the Lord love the Lord, but the Lord also loves his devotees. It's a mutual loving relationship. You know, when we're told to love God and to give everything to God, to surrender everything to God, sometimes we may see that as a very one-way street. You know, especially religions that teach, well, you should love God or you're going to go to hell. You know, that's not really a very nice kind of love. If I say, you know, you should love me or I'm going to shoot you, you know, that's not love. That's the kind of thing, you know, rapists do. You know, that's not a loving relationship. So the reality is that Krishna loves us far more than we love him. And he's so full of love for all living entities, but especially for his devotees, especially for those who are pure in love of God. So this is just a little idea about Haridas Thakura. We have a few minutes for some discussion. Yes? If anyone has any questions. There's many, many stories about Haridas Thakura in a book called Chaitanya Charitamrita, and also in a book called Chaitanya Bhagavat, which is basically this story of the life of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his associates. So anybody have any questions?
I missed a few minutes, so maybe I missed something about chanting constantly.
So, chanting the holy name of the Lord is both a spiritual practice to achieve enlightenment and love of God, and it is also a symptom of one who's already enlightened with love of God. Something like, if you have a relationship with someone you love in this world. So you do things to grow your love with that person, and you also do the same things to express love that's already there. So if you're trying to establish a loving relationship with someone, you may give them flowers. Right? A man to a woman will give her flowers or jewelry. Although I've heard now that the jewelry businesses are really struggling because people now are giving electronics instead of jewelry. So, you know, when you're trying to have, when you're trying to start a relationship with someone, there's certain things that you do that foster love and certain things that aren't usually associated with that. You know, if a man's wooing a woman, he doesn't usually give her, you know, lawnmower parts. Give her flowers or candy or jewelry or something like that. But after you've already established a relationship, you're already married, you're already in love with each other, he's still going to give her flowers and candy and jewelry and so forth as an expression of the love that's already there. So the giving food, you know, you give food to people that you're trying to get a relationship with, and you give food to people with whom you already have a relationship with. So people who are already fully enlightened of love of God, they like to say God's name. And people who are trying to become enlightened in love of God also say God's name. So the people who are trying to become enlightened, it's a spiritual practice. It's a discipline even. And it can be seen, you know, people might see it as some sort of ritual that one is doing. It may look like that if the relationship isn't established yet. Just like, again, if you want to love someone in this world, you can buy books, you know, how to deal with a man you want to love you, how to deal with a woman you want to love you. I remember songs like that when I was a teenager, you know, if you really want him to love you, then wear your hair like this and talk like this and say this and don't say this, right? And the internet is full of this kind of advice every day. And it's like some sort of a ritual. Okay, well I got to get up and see. What does it say here? You know, and I remember myself getting this book about like how to be, you know, how to appeal to men and to say this and don't say this and say this. And I was thinking, oh, I've been doing it all wrong, you know. When the man said this, I said this, and then that just made him upset. When he says this, I should say this. And then I would do it and it would work, and I'd say, wow, that's a great book. Right? So it's almost ritualistic, right? Say this, do this. Okay, well, how do I do this empathic listening? Instead of saying, you're driving me crazy, I say, what do I say? I'm feeling irritated at the, and if, right? And you have like a formula. But really, relationships are not about rituals and formulas. They're not. If you really have a deep, loving relationship with somebody, it's not about rituals and formulas. So chanting the holy name of the Lord looks like a ritual, it looks like a formula, it looks like a kind of practice. We even use the Sanskrit word sadhana, which means practice. If you hang out with Hare Krishna devotees, they'll say things like, I'm doing my sadhana, I have to do my sadhana, I have to do my practice. But in a sense, it really isn't. Because if one's love is awakened, you're going to do those very same things. The difference is you're going to do them spontaneously. You're going to do them just naturally. Now, materially, I don't think that ever really happens. What I see in our relationships in this world is it never gets to the point of 100% spontaneity. There's always some work. But spiritually, it gets to the point of complete and 100% spontaneity. Do you have to leave before our multimedia show? Oh, I'm sorry. You're very welcome. So we try to be absorbed in what those who are already liberated are doing naturally. We take what are the behaviors of people who are already enlightened, who already have love of God, what do they do, And then we do those similar activities as a practice. And because the state of enlightenment or love of God is natural to the soul, when you do those activities as a practice, at some point it starts sparking the fact that it's natural and it becomes spontaneous. So those who are not yet awakened are chanting as a practice, and those who are awakened are chanting because it's just the natural, spontaneous thing that they do in their enlightened, awakened state. It's just natural. I mean, just it's like, again, there's so many love songs out in the world where people will just say the name of the person. You know, I mean, I remember songs like that. Gloria, Gloria. Oh, hey, Paul. Oh, hey, Paul. I remember that one. So they're just saying these names, and they're just repeating the names over and over again of the person they love. So that's natural. Now, with God's names, his name is himself. You know, the name of Gloria or Paul is just incidental. Somebody got named Paul because their great uncle was named Paul, and that's not intrinsically who they are. They can legally change their name and they remain the same person. But with Krishna, his name is actually himself. And as one chants that name, one starts to understand, oh, wow, this is not just some name. It's not a mundane sound. So I think you wanted us to end at this time? Okay, and then we'll have the multimedia show. Okay. It's not really